Hey, Cargill, you want to see something really scary?
Yeah.
You want to see something really, really scary?
Yeah, come on, show me.
Okay.
Dear God, what is that?
It's a bagel bite I found under the radiator. You can pet it, I don't think it bites.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
You little monsters, to another big episode of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast where a wizard and a boy who could fly carry on about their favorite fattening foods and forgotten movies and vice versa.
You're the boy who could fly, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, as you wish. I am joined, as always, by my friend and co-host, a man who worked behind the counter in a video store for most of his wonder years, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
A wizard!
I am not sure why I went with a Fred Savage-themed opening.
I have no idea where that came from.
Because it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. But,
None whatsoever.
But there you have it, folks. I want to remind you that brilliance like that can be found on iTunes. And hey, if you're going to go to iTunes to check us out, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? We really like to see those. We very much appreciate it. You can also get us on Stitcher if you're not much of an iTunes user. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And by the way, every movie we talk about, we're going to put an Amazon link here on the page on Film School Rejects. If you click on that link and go to Amazon, even if you don't buy that item, just by getting to Amazon via our link, anything you buy supports the show, and we really appreciate it.
But I'm going to put a pause in there for a second.
Ooh, a caveat.
I never caveat this. This month, we have a very special theme going on, which we will get on to. So this month in particular, if there was ever a month to hop on the Amazon page, and whether it's through ours, which helps us out, or whether you just boot up, you know, bring up Amazon your own way, whatever, the people we're talking about this month can all use your support, and every Blu-ray, every DVD, every VOD matters to these people. And except maybe one of them. One of them could probably carry on very easily, but we'll get to that in weeks. But But this is the month where it's like, hey, please seek this stuff out, pick this stuff up, support these folks.
I agree 100%, because part of our mission statement here at Junk Food Cinema, in addition to sort of shamelessly devouring the cheesier fare that we adore so much, is to spotlight those films and those creators who haven't gotten the props and or the mainstream recognition that they deserve. And with a lot of the filmmakers we're going to be highlighting this month, we see their movies at festivals. I mean, you know, our cohorts, I mean, we all fall in love with the work of these artists, and they're in the perfect setting to see them. But then after that, it's this, you know, they just kind of fade into obscurity, and we cannot let that happen. So for the month of April, we thought we'd shine a spotlight on those filmmakers whose work in genre filmmaking will undoubtedly someday land them the status of classic. Ladies and gentlemen, we give you the modern Junk Food Masters.
Hell yes.
Hell yeah. I'm really excited to talk about this because I feel like the festival environment really allows us to get to know these guys, not only from the ground floor, but to really actually get to know them. I mean, especially Fantastic Fest, yeah, where there is no divide between somebody who's visiting with the film and somebody's there to see films. They hang out, they drink. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, not everyone we're going to talk about are people we know from the festival circuit, but
but a lot of them are.
Yes. But that's the thing is that there are, you know, there are some people making some really amazing junk food right now. Really, you know, your kind of movies, our kind of movies. Making movies because they want to see fun movies. They want to experience the kinds of movies that we grew up with through a modern lens. And so we picked out some of our favorite collections of folks who have substantial bodies of work to draw on. We're, you know, it's rather than picking, you know, people we met who we really love who've made one or two movies, we are really going after people who have, you know, really have a body of work that you can look at.
True.
And cannot say, look, these guys are just choosing their friends. It's like, no, these guys are choosing guys who have been making stuff for, you know, the you know, some better part of the last decade or longer.
Exactly.
And have had a substantial impact on, if not just the indie horror set or indie genre set, on the mainstream. And these are some really amazing talents, some of them just coming up, and and we've yet to see their best stuff. Some of them just hitting their huge strides, you know. It's a really exciting time. It's really interesting. It made me think about something, because I was watching one of the movies that we're going to talk about in a later episode earlier today, and I was looking at it that it was 2010, and then was looking up their film career and seeing, you know, the various projects they worked on and seeing how that fell in, and thinking about all the other movies that came out around them, and just really reveling in the fact that the last 6-7 years has been a really amazing renaissance of genre film, and and especially with the new methods of indie distribution, we've really gotten a chance to see a whole host of new voices, and really that's a lot of what we want to talk about.
Right, and I mean, and that's the other thing that's kind of important about talking about these guys now is you look at the guys that started off making, you know, little festival genre films that people really fell in love with. And those guys are now directing things like Jurassic World and soon to be Star Wars Episode 8.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you never know. Doctor Strange, some would say.
I don't know if a certain writing partner of mine might have become the director of that after Sinister, maybe.
Maybe. You could probably verify that via IMDb. We are kicking off this month.
Actually, I rarely do this.
But you keep saying that.
Because today's one of those days where I'm just breaking the rules. I'm just like, you know, we normally have a rhythm, but today I'm like, fuck it.
No rhythm.
We rarely share interesting little bits that have come up in our lives and things in the podcast, but I have to today.
Yeah.
Apparently someone went and added their name as the writer for Sinister 2 on IMDb. Some paranormal investigator. I started getting emails from Pete Hall, a good friend of ours, earlier this morning, going, dude, did he do some work on this, or is he just a guy going around adding his name to a bunch of movies?
And like Spectre in the Night, adding his name to supernatural film projects.
And I just had to laugh. I was just like, that's hilarious. No, I have no idea who this guy is.
That's called ghostwriting. Hey-o! I'm kind of proud of that.
Really?
Yeah, no,
really?
I am.
You're proud of that?
I am proud of that one.
I was fine that that came out, but being proud of that, that's kind of the bridge too far.
Kind of proud of it.
All right, so let's get into the episode.
We're kicking off this month with a 1-2 gut punch of awesome in the form of Adam Green and Joe Lynch. Now, you may be asking yourself, why do one episode about both of them instead of giving each one of them their own episode? And to me, it made sense to do a combined episode of these guys for two reasons. One, because they are such good friends, and two, because they often draw from a very similar well of inspiration. And I think you can kind of see, if you examine both of their catalogs together, you can kind of see that overlap, and it's really interesting.
Well, and they've done a number of projects together. They do a yearly short together, a yearly Halloween short. I believe their desks are actually next to each other.
Aww.
At Arioscope, at their film.
You guys are so cute.
Yeah, adorable. We love you guys. No, but these guys, these guys are the peanut butter and jelly of horror right now. I mean, really, they are the PB&J. They go so amazingly well together, but are awesome on their own. And we just felt, you know, since there were so many great voices to do this month, we're like, well, yeah, we could do an episode on Adam and Joe together. That would be great. So, and especially since I almost always see them together.
Yeah, that is...
Like, they literally just came to town a few weeks ago to show a double feature of their films that they both put out, and to do their podcast and do a Q&A after. Like, that's... Because that's how they roll. They really are best fucking friends.
And we're gonna start looking at Adam's career. I'm sure we'll be bouncing around a lot. I'm not expecting a lot of structure from this episode, because we have a lot to talk about.
And because I'm just kind of throwing structure out the window.
Yeah, because as much as I work on having a structure and a format and show notes and all that stuff, Cargill just comes in here like a bull in a china shop.
It's kind of roll.
Who's
up.
Also on bath salts. It's a bull who's on bath salts in a china shop.
It's... How do you take your coffee? Okay? Seriously?
That's a good question. It's a good question, right up the ass. So Hatchet is the first film we're going to talk about, because Hatchet is kind of the movie that I don't want to use a cliche expression like kind of put Adam Green on the map, but it's the film that I think most people, when they think of Adam Green, if they know him from anything, that's the thing they know him from.
Well, that was the movie that put him on the map.
Yeah, but it's so cliche.
It is, except that it's he made an early film, and I don't know if it's ever been released. I know that it got him interest at it was a super low budget thing. I think he shot it for $400. And it got him interest by studios, and you know that's what got him his foot in the door.
Are you talking about Coffee and Donuts?
Yeah.
Okay.
I couldn't remember if it was Coffee and Donuts or Donuts and Coffee, but yeah. So that got his foot in the door, but it you know nobody saw it, and but it got him the juice that he needed to put together this little movie, Hatchet, this little $1 million horror movie. And this is the movie that he showed up with at Fantastic Fest, and everybody was like, holy shit, what the hell is this? And it really kind of just, it tickled us in all the right ways, but I'll let you go into that part of it.
Yeah. I mean, what Hatchet is it's a love letter to 80s slasher films and specifically, Friday the 13th genre, and right down to the fact that they get Kane Hodder, who played Jason from Friday the 13th Part 7 all the way to Jason X. I mean, he is the guy that most hardcore Friday fans feel is the Jason. And he's got him playing a character called Victor Crowley, and he's kind of creating his own myth around this new slasher killer that takes place in the Louisiana Bayou. Very tragic story about a deformed child who had a dad that really did love him, but you know the town couldn't stop picking on him, and they moved into seclusion, and there's a fire one night, and in an effort to save the boy from a burning house, accidentally kills him with a hatchet. Leave that to stew for a while, local legend. Now they're taking swamp tours out there to see where Victor Crowley lives, the lair of Victor Crowley.
Victor Crowley.
Because if it's New Orleans, they're going to turn, and it's history, they're going to turn it into a tourist attraction. That is one thing I do love about New Orleans, is that they will pretty much sell tickets to anything. So that's kind of the setup here, and what this turns into is a very bombastic, blood against the walls, sometimes literally gore fest, that is very much a nod to a specific era of horror filmmaking that is obviously among Adam Green's favorite subgenres. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that how he approached this movie is he wanted to write a love letter to slasher films before they started becoming self-referential.
Mm-hmm.
So he's talking about that era that we often speak about in here. He's talking about, you know, 1980 to 1984. Because once you get past then, that's where you start getting so many horror movies that just know what they are. And so they get goofy about it. And he wanted to make something that wasn't goofy, that took that kind of what became a goofy premise and treated it with seriousness, and had humor in it, but the humor was never about making the villain weaker or stupid or funny. It was, you know, the characters being funny, or you laughing at the absurdity of just how bloody or gory a particular scene got.
Yeah, you know, that's very true. It's important to note that there is nothing funny about Victor Crowley. Kane Hodder plays that role so like he's so unbound in that, you know, in that makeup, that it's you're kind of scared for actors as much as characters. Like, you watch him interact and you're like, man, I hope he didn't hurt anybody on set, because he's a very zealous individual, especially when he is playing roles of monsters that he really loves. And man, you could see that in the Victor Crowley performance. He's really going for it and really having a blast.
Yeah, if you're a slasher movie fan and you haven't seen Hatchet, Hatchet needs to be one of those movies that you put in your queue ASAP. It's fun. It's over the top in all the right ways. It's really cleverly written. Adam does an unbelievable amount with the $1 million that he has. He makes the movie look a hell of a lot bigger than it actually is. It's funny that the most of the scenes in the woods are they're on a, you know, in a set. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't shoot outside. They literally just had some genius set designer who is also, you know, something of a mad gardener, like, set up this thing, and it shots that are not outdoors do actually feel outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really great, and it's really funny, and this is This has, I'm blanking on his name now, Joel David Moore. Yeah, who many of you will know as, you know, the nerdy scientist guy from Avatar. And he's kind of your lead, male lead in this, and is really, really fucking funny in this. In fact, I think this is one of his funniest roles.
I really like Joel David Moore's collaborations with Adam Green. Like, I don't think I've ever liked Joel David Moore more than when he works with Adam Green.
That sounds like a segue.
You know what? It may just be a segue, although before we move on to what I'm clearly segueing into, I do want to offer this disclaimer. I respect Hatchet a lot. I like a lot of things about it, but overall as a film, just so you know, I'm not blowing smoke, I'm a little at arm's length with it, because I think there's a lot of things about it that really work, and I think there are a lot of things about it that in an effort to be reverent toward that genre, he makes some missteps. One of the things is I love his he has a no CGI rule with this movie. Absolutely no CGI. And of course I'm going to respect that. But one of the problems I had with this movie as opposed to the sequel was the makeup on Kane Hodder was a little bit it looked like a single piece, like that makeup piece on his face was almost like a single piece of latex and didn't offer for a lot of expression, which when you see the sequel is something that they specifically fixed. And also the girl playing Mary Beth, for my money, just doesn't have a lot of charisma, doesn't have a lot of I didn't get behind her very much. But then again, when they switched that in the second one, also worked better.
See, and here's the oddity, and this is what's interesting about this, is I'm just the opposite on you.
Most people are. I realize I'm in a minority here.
No, I don't think you are, but I like Hatchet much more than I like Hatchet 2. We'll talk about that.
Maybe we should segue from Hatchet to Hatchet 2. Maybe that makes more sense.
Yeah, and then we'll circle back around to Joel David
Moore.
We'll
spiral back around and talk about,
Let's just jump into 2, and then we'll go over to Spiral. So we're now jumping out of chronological order and going into conceptual order. So Hatchet 2, I am not as in love with Hatchet 2 as many other people are. In fact, it's my least favorite of Adam's films.
Of his films. I thought you were going to say of that franchise. Okay.
No. No, of his films. No.
We've seen Hatchet 3, yes.
Well, yes, but Adam didn't direct that.
No, I realize this.
He produced it. But yeah, no, it's of Adam's films, it's the only one I don't love.
Really?
And that's the thing, is I really do. I enjoy thoroughly all of Adam's films, except this one. It went a little too far for me. In fact, it goes back to what we were talking about in with the first film, where he wanted to make a horror franchise that felt like those horror movies before they got self-referential and too goofy. And this movie ratchets that up and goes really kind of bugfuck nuts, berserko, wonky, silly. And that was what I didn't enjoy about it, was I was like, oh man. And it's like, I get it. And some of the jokes are really funny, but what I loved about Hatchet was that it gave me that kind of experience that I had watching those films that you just don't get anymore, because you can't make them straight face anymore. And then he went on to make one of those that you can make in this day and age. And I was just like, oh, I was hoping, and it was partially an expectation thing, but I've gone back and rewatched it. And there's a lot of elements I really do like. There's a couple of really amazing kills in this. There's a couple of really good fucking jokes. Mm-hmm.
Including a really good fucking joke.
Yes.
Yes. One of the most awkward sex scenes of all time.
And a really good fucking kill.
It's a great kill. It's a great. See, okay, here's my thing. I get what you're saying, and I get what he was trying to do with the first one, but I feel like there is a unity of tone in the horror and the comedy in 2 that is a little skewed in the first one. Like, I agree with you. Like, it's good that nothing about Victor Crowley is funny in the first one, but some of the humor in the first one doesn't work for me either, because it seems so at odds with the legitimately scary stuff. So I think what I liked more about 2 is it's like, well, if we're going to be that silly, then we should just be that silly. Like, we shouldn't try and have our cake and eat it too. We should, if we're going to be that silly, let's be that silly throughout. And I think they really pull it off. And one of the things that's interesting is that the storyline for the second one is that the survivor, the girl who survived the first one, is now leading a hunting party back into the woods to try, and she's still looking for her father and her brother, who, by the way, in the first 10 seconds of the first one, are supremely dead. Like, could not be more dead. Her father's played by Robert Englund, by the way, who was obviously Freddy Krueger.
Well, you're talking about who played her father. We need to mention that this is a completely different actress.
Oh, it is a completely different actress.
that in the second one, it's the actress from the first movie, and they've just changed actresses. And she is played by...
Danielle Harris.
Hell yes.
So that's the great thing about this franchise, is there's a lot of actual horror mainstays that show up. Kane Hodder, we've already mentioned. Robert Englund, we've already mentioned. Of course, Reverend Zombie, played by Tony Todd. Voodoo. Okay. Magic.
Tony Todd.
Tony Todd, who gets a bigger part in the second
and then
one.
Danielle, have you ever been in a horror movie before, Harris?
Oh, my God. Danielle Harris, by the way, if you're not familiar, is played the little girl, Jamie, in Halloween's 4 and 5.
And she was the crush of all of us young horror nerds in the 80s. Like, for those of us of a certain age, you're talking about me, we're talking about Adam, we're talking about Joe, we're talking about other guys of our age. We were about the exact same age as Danielle Harris when she was in Halloween 4 and 5. And she was this adorable little girl that's our age, that's in fucking horror movies. And she was, it was that crush that went on. And then, of course, she's in it, you know, she goes on to do...
Last Boy Scout.
Yeah, Last Boy Scout. And hey, look, she's still our same age. Fucking awesome. And so, yeah, and then she happened to grow up to be super hot and continue to do horror movies for quite some time. And then recently she came to Austin to be a guest for a movie that she was in. And, of course, since then, she's been in Halloween 4 and 5 and then was subsequently in Rob Zombie's Halloween and has done, you know, the Hatchet movies, shows up. And the Q&A guy has clearly not done his homework.
Look, let me defend a little bit this guy, although I kind of want to kick him in the nuts. First of all, at Fantastic Fest, sometimes they will just grab you out of the hallway to do a Q&A.
This is like, true. Hey, I wasn't going to call the guy out fully.
It's like, we don't have anybody. Can you do this? And sometimes you get thrown into things you haven't even seen. And you're just like, okay, well, I'll do it. So you don't know who this person is or what the movie's about. So on that level, I get it. But for God's sake, man, Danielle Harris, for fuck's sake.
One of his first questions is, have you ever been in a horror movie?
I believe the actual way he phrased it is, so this is your first horror movie. And then the audience went, no. Like, this is like one unified, like, the fuck kind of situation. Yeah, that was an interesting day.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy when somebody who's almost their entire career is genre films.
Yeah.
At the, you know, and most of it horror. But that's become, every time Danielle Harris comes up, that's become one of the running jokes around town.
Have you ever been in a horror film?
Has she ever been in a horror film?
I don't know.
Before?
I don't think she has. But I mean, this, like, if you thought the first Hatchet was gory, which it is yes, like gleefully gory. This one takes it up to 11 and then it rips the knob off and shoves it in your ocular cavity because it's already ripped your eyes out. Like, it is super, super bloody. And I have a lot of fun with just how audacious they go with some of the kills, and the whole hunting party element of, like, we're gonna go get Victor Crowley is so much fun. And actually, we talked about the fucking kill, or the fucking joke, which features AJ Bowen, who's a guy we're gonna talk a lot about in subsequent weeks. But the most awkward sex scene of a woman, like, basically he's having sex with her doggy style, and she's like, how much do you love me? And he's just like, the most amount. And she's like, do you love me more than baby Jesus? And he's like, that's inappropriate. Like, as they're fucking in the middle of the woods. Yeah. Hilarious.
Yeah. Now let me step back a moment. One of the other things that you're going to find these two gentlemen we're talking about today have in common is they get fucked a lot.
They get fucked so much. I literally have this in my notes that says, I think that's another reason these two guys belong in a tandem episode, because it's a double-ended dildo of the industry that they're both getting fucked.
They're constantly, these guys are constantly getting fucked. And the Hatchet 1, the first Hatchet movie, was probably one of the biggest clusterfucks, or the most public clusterfucks of their careers, in which the movie ended up getting a NC-17 rating.
That's actually the second one. That's what happened in the second one. The second one got an NC-17 rating, which was the first time that had happened to a horror film since Dawn of the Dead. And so what happened was the MPAA gave Hatchet 2 an NC-17 rating, and the filmmakers decided that they were going to go around the MPAA and just go straight to AMC theaters. And AMC theaters was like, yeah, we don't care. We love this movie. We're absolutely on board with it. They saw the cut. They're like, this is fine. They put it out. It's going to be a wide release. Super good news for Adam Green. And then after, I think it was like two showings or 2 days even, they...
It wasn't even... It was that on the first
day. Very brief amount of time. They just decided, oh, no, never mind.
No, and it wasn't that they decided. It was that there was a lot of pressure. See, one of the things that doesn't often get talked about is why there aren't more NC-17 movies. And the main reason there aren't more NC-17 movies is there are large groups of... fundamentalist Christians who organize and write letter writing campaigns to movie theaters and pressure them and threaten them into not showing NC-17 films. So in order to get a movie into most theater chains have made it a policy so that they can just blanket, you know, not deal with these nut bars who don't understand that, well, if you don't like an NC-17 movie, don't go pay to see it, and your kids can't see it either because they're not allowed to go in and see it. So they have a disconnect there, but distributors and the theaters are just like, no, we're just going to show rated R movies. That's it. Nothing lower than that. So when AMC went around that with this movie, they got a hell of a lot of pressure, you know, out of the gate, and lots of people coming down on it. There was an article written about it by a Politico. I'm blanking on who it was. It was a guy who was high up in the Bush administration on the Huffington Post about the absurdity of these NC-17 movies coming out. Because it came out with another NC-17 movie. That was the same weekend as I Spit on Your Grave, the I Spit on Your Grave remake. So these came out that very. It was either the same weekend or it was two weeks apart. Mm-hmm. I think it may have actually been a week apart. But Hatchet 2 was first, and then there was this limited release, and there's this big pushback against how violent this stuff was getting. And of course, you've got a movie that is goofy but really absurd and occasionally obscene and over the top, like Hatchet 2, and then you've got a movie that is, you know, just really
rancid is how I would describe the remake of I Spit on Your Grave.
I actually enjoyed that version. But this caused a big shitstorm, and with that brewing, the person who caught all the flack was Adam Green. And Adam had his movie yanked out either by the end of the first day or at the beginning, middle of the day two. Like, he did not get a full opening weekend. And AMC just totally buckled, backed out, pulled the rug out from under him. And it was seen as a colossal failure on Adam's part, when in fact it wasn't. When it was a movie theater chain that said, we've got balls, we've got the stones to do this. We believe our audiences are adults and can make up their own minds. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, no, we were wrong. We don't have the stones. We're very sorry. And gives a nice big middle finger to fucking Adam. And it was a huge, colossal fuck up. And we've seen certain things happen like that since over the years, but Adam's kind of become that classic example of the modern guys who've really gotten screwed over by distributors and theater chains, you know, just not getting their shit together.
Let's jump over to Joe Lynch for a second, because I feel like this is a good segue in the realm of getting fucked over, and we'll get to that in just a second. But the road, like Joe Lynch's road to, you know, being a director started with a lot of wrong turns. In fact, Wrong Turn 2 was kind of his big, you know, his big break. Now,
his entry into the, yeah.
What I like about this is that this is a movie, Wrong Turn, that should not have a franchise, that now has an absurdly huge franchise, but...
Well, no. The Wrong Turn franchise isn't huge. The thing is...
There's seven of them.
Yes, and six of them were direct-to-video.
I'm saying in terms of number, obviously they're not good movies that anyone has seen, but there are seven of them when there shouldn't be two of them.
Except for...
But Wrong Turn 2, right out of the gate, it opens with so much promise that I was kind of like, oh, maybe Wrong Turn could be a cool franchise, and then no, it wasn't. But the decision to have reality TV contestants comprise the victim pool is so... so satisfying. And I think very early on he realized, I'm making a Wrong Turn 2 sequel that's going to go direct to video. I'm going to have fun with it. I'm going to treat this movie like it's the last thing I will ever do. And that's why it's so much fun.
And yeah, the thing is Joe was essentially one of these young up and coming directors along with this pool of guys. And Adam was the first guy to really kind of pop out. And in fact, for a while, there was a running joke about being a fog, and a fog was an FOG, a friend of Green. And that was, you know, you were essentially getting into various screenings and such, 'cause you knew Adam. Joe was one of these people, and that's how I met him. I met him actually 3 months before his film played at Fantastic Fest and then was subsequently released, because he was hanging out with a bunch of the young horror, Turks of the mid aughts. And he got in with this direct-to-video deal, and he was required to shoot the script that they had given him. That was the thing. And he could not go over his $500,000 budget. That was the rule. And aside from that, if he could make things work, if he could make it work on budget, he could do whatever he wanted as long as he didn't fuck with the script. Mm-hmm. And so he was locked into this script for this sequel. There were a lot of things he wanted to change, but he's like, let me make the best goddamn version of this that I can. And that's exactly what he did. And he made a very funny, a very cool, kind of slick movie for no money. He brought it. He had a couple of interesting, like there's a Patton Oswalt cameo in this. The movie opens with Patton Oswalt as the agent on the phone, you know, talking to one of the characters who then gets beautifully sliced in half in one of the coolest death scenes of the last 10 years.
Would you like a slice of ingenue? We're serving up fresh ingenue today.
Dude, it, like, seriously, that death is, I would put that in easily top 10 deaths of the last 10 years.
300 gallons of fake blood used on this movie, by the way, and every drop of it is well earned, and you can't help but cheer when you watch this movie. Even if you hated the first Wrong Turn, it's shameless in the best way possible.
Yeah, and I'm glad we kind of jumped over to Lynch, because this was this body of their career.
Yes.
And this was, you know, this was the bloody, gory, fun, let's go back and make the kind of movies we grew up with and make homages to that. And which was also, you know, a very cool thing to do at the time, which is also cycled back around. We're seeing that again right now.
Yeah.
And we're seeing certain people really starting to, critics getting upset with, okay, can we stop making 80s movies now? And some of us are like, no.
Not at all.
No, we keep on seeing them. This is their bloody turn. And then the next phase of their careers is where things start getting really interesting.
Definitely.
So let's circle back real quick, spiral back if we will.
Spiral back indeed.
To Adam. Worked with Joel David Moore to co-direct this weird, cool little super low-budget thriller called Spiral.
It's not anything like any of the other movies we're going to talk about.
No.
Today.
In fact, it was the first moment that we realized, holy shit, Adam is not just a flesh and blood guy. He's not just a schlock guy. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of fucking range. And Spiral just really connected with me. It's a really cool, oddball, tense thriller horror story.
Yeah, and that movie lives and dies by performance.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of the movies we talk about live and die by their concept and the execution of that concept, this movie lives and dies by its performances. And Joel David Moore, again, co-directing it, co-wrote the movie, but the performance that Adam Green gets out of him is unlike, and like I said, when I saw this movie, it completely changed how I felt about this guy. Because I was like, oh, this is just a flash in the pan, weird looking dude that's going to be in a few Ben Stiller movies or Will Ferrell movies and then disappear. To, no, this is a serious actor. Like, yeah. This is a kid who's got chops.
And I think this may have been one of the films that got him noticed by Cameron to come over. Because he's returning for the next
Avatar sequels.
Movies.
Yeah.
So you're going to see him again. But yeah, and he's opposite Amber Tamblyn, who also does a really good job in this film, and is really, really does a fantastic job of being kind of the heart of this movie while we're watching Joel kind of do his thing.
And I like the way it plays with certain expectations. I don't want to say too much, but there are certain expectations when Amber Tamblyn is brought into the picture and the relationship between the two of them. There, you start to get a sense that it's going one way, and it's a way that you've seen before. And then things shift, And yeah, they make some really bold choices.
You know, the best thing that we can compare it to is A Horrible Way to Die.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
You know, the Adam Wingard, Simon Barrett film.
Yep. That we might be talking about pretty soon.
We might. Who knows?
It's possible. Who knows? Thank you, rock monster from the Neverending Story. So yes, Spiral. It's like I said, it's unlike either of the movies that we're going to talk about this entire day from either filmmaker, because it is very personal. It is very, it's a very introspective movie, and it's a dramatic thriller, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
And this is probably one we're going to spend the least time talking about, because if you like Adam Green,
just go see it.
If you've enjoyed any of his films, give this one a shot and just go in without us having spoiled it and deconstructed it for you, because it really is a film that should be experienced without a foreknowledge. So go in and watch that one. And now let's move into the next phase of Green and Lynch's career, which is their slick and sadly underappreciated genre films.
Yes.
One of which they got really fucked over on.
So fucked!
But let's talk about the one that didn't get fucked first. We've got Frozen, another Adam Green.
My favorite Adam Green film.
Adam Green's,
by far.
I don't know if it's my favorite. I know that it is his best, and it is his the
That's
one.
Fair.
It's the one that when I talk to people about Adam, and they're like, "Oh, I didn't like Hatchet." It's like, "Well, watch Frozen."
Just watch Frozen.
And it's like, if you don't like Frozen, you're not gonna dig anything that Adam does, because Frozen is Adam, and you guys are like, "Wait, Frozen?"
No, not the Disney movie. Although when I sat down to watch the Disney flick, part of me really wanted to see wolves dart out of the woods and tear Olaf to pieces.
I hear that sales are up on the movie. that they've been selling an awful lot of DVDs and VOD over
wait,
the past
wait, wait,
year.
Wait, does Redbox have Braille now? Why is this accidentally getting rented
on
instead
Amazon?
Of Frozen?
People like people,
but you can see the box, right? Like, you can tell that that's not a Disney movie.
The average IQ of the average American is 97, not 100. That's the average. Mathematically speaking, half the country is dumber than 97 IQ.
Okay.
They're buying and renting Frozen, and so,
concordantly,
yes,
vis-a-vis science.
And then there, I don't know how many stories there are. I'm sure there's some. I'm sure Adam's probably full of them at this point, of people who have bought it or rented it and then put the iPad in front of their parent, you know, their kids, and mommy, this isn't quiet back there. I got you your movie. Just sit down. You know, I don't know how many of those there are. This movie's so fucking good.
It is
so good. It is a movie that, you know, for those of you that don't know the premise, it's three college-age kids end up getting stuck on a forklift,
a ski lift. Forklift would have been a lot easier to deal with.
How do we get out of this forklift?
Just climb down.
Just
step off of it.
I can't. I'm too scared.
You're 3 feet off the ground.
They get stuck on a ski lift 50 feet in the air while there's a week off between people coming back. And how do you get off of the ski lift? How do you not freeze to death?
They have
nothing. They are screwed. And it's all about them trying to get down and the human drama of it. And it is so fucking masterfully crafted.
Yeah.
Like, the way he tells a story in which most of the movie occurs on a fucking ski lift is amazing. It is just fantastic, the way it works and the way it's put together. And it's the film that shows that Adam is capable of such amazing things.
Absolutely.
That if somebody just comes along and gives this man $30 million and goes, "Go and make this genre film," he will churn out something fantastic. And the proof is in the pudding, but it didn't really connect with people. It was kind of sold as a horror movie, mm-hmm. and people refer to it as a horror movie, but there's not really a lot of horror in it.
It's horror the same way that like sort of Man versus the Elements movies are. Like, so if you think Jeremiah Johnson is a horror movie, then maybe Frozen is also a horror movie. But what I find really great about this is he takes such an outlandish concept of, we're going to do this movie where it's just three people suspended 50 feet in the air on a ski lift, and he goes all out with it. And what I mean by that is, those dangling up in the air, that's not CG. He actually filmed those guys 50 feet in the air on a ski lift usually sitting in the car behind them shooting with his own camera himself because his DOP wouldn't go up there. Funny story about that, Adam Green is actually terrified of heights, and yet he's up there holding his camera because his director of photography didn't want to go up there. But they're really up in the air. Everything about this movie is authentic. Everything about this movie is genuine, which is not only what makes this movie good, but kind of what epitomizes Green as a filmmaker.
The problem with this movie, its biggest problem is it falls prey to... it falls prey to a real problem in cinema. And this is something that I talk to a lot of writers about. There is a very real problem with being smarter than your audience. And this movie is smarter than its audience. Green actually went and did the research on all the things he locations, sizes, weights, height, there's a number of things that happened in this movie. He wanted to make sure everything was authentic and everything would happen the way that it would happen. He wanted to make sure that none of it was bullshit. And I watched this with a theater full of people who crossed their arms and goes, "That's fucking bullshit. Yeah. I happen to know. I'm from the North. I live in the North. I know this is bullshit. I know that this doesn't do this."
To which I say bullshit. Because I've heard that same thing. I watched it with people who were like, "Why wouldn't they just do this? That's a stupid decision." I'm like,
yeah.
Really? Really? You've been in this situation and you know exactly what you would do and what you should do.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
And it's countered. There's one of the famous examples that we see in movies. We just saw it in Lucy last year. We saw it in Inception, where they use the famous 10% of the brain myth. And a lot of it drives people nuts. They're like, "I hate this. Why do they keep repeating this fucking myth? I happen to be smart and know that it's a myth. And if I know it, then everyone else should know it. So let's stop repeating it. Fuck you, this movie's terrible." And it's like, when you actually talk to the directors, Luc Besson did this great interview. He's like, they asked him about that. He goes, "Of course, that's fucking bullshit. It's a myth. But how do you explain something to an average filmgoer very quickly and very easily? It's an amazing metaphor that everyone thinks they know that instantly clicks in their head, and they use that tool. They give the wrong information because most of the audience believes the information's right. Because sometimes when you give the right information, like in this movie, the audience thinks it's wrong, mm-hmm. and they instantly question it and dislike the movie because they think they're smarter than the movie when the movie's actually smarter than them. And this is one of those great examples of a movie that got turned. Like right now, we probably have people yelling at the podcast, in their cars, waving their arms around going, no, I've seen Frozen. That's bullshit. That couldn't really happen. Nobody would ever, that would never happen to anybody. This doesn't happen this way. I happen to know because I live in the North." And I keep repeating that because I know half a dozen people who have literally used that as the, I understand skiing with physics. Stop
you. I live in the North. I don't go skiing. Okay. That's just fucking stupid. Why would you accelerate yourself into trees?
Yes.
If you want to die, there's so much quicker and less expensive ways.
There are some really great ways to die.
Just saying.
There's some horrible ways to die.
There are some horrible ways to die.
That's the second time we've mentioned a movie we're not even talking about tonight.
Ooh, trailers for the next show. I love Frozen. I think you're right on about it being a situation where the movie, in trying to be authentic, unfortunately rings false to some people. And to me, like, I was in it. Like, I believed every moment, and it was harrowing is exactly the word I would use for this, because everything they did, you could completely understand, because it's like, it's this or die. It is last-ditch effort from about the end of the first act on. Everything that happens from the end of the first act to the end of the movie is like a last resort on top of a last resort.
Yeah, and oh God, Sean Ashmore. Is
Iceman himself.
Iceman could freeze to death. That's the sweet, delicious irony in this movie. Iceman could freeze to death in Frozen. And he gives probably one of his best performances.
Agreed.
I've seen him in a number of things. And this is the movie where you like him the most, you connect with him the most, and he's just fantastic. This is the total package Adam Green movie. Like, if you don't like this, if you don't think this is well put together, if you can't see the masterful nature that it was that in the way it was assembled, then you will not appreciate any of the work of Adam Green, because he is just he is a really, really amazing filmmaker. So we go that Frozen.
This mirror image thing is really interesting to me that we keep doing with Lynch and Green, because they started off making very gory, very 80s reverent horror films, and then they move on and they do something a little bit more interesting, and then they get their really slick movies. As we were talking about Frozen, and we'll talk about Lynch's really slick movie in a moment. But first, we have to kind of touch upon his middle ground, which is also his turn to be fucked by the industry.
Yes, but this was his first slick film, because this movie, you know, looks like a well budgeted movie. It's a low budget movie, but it looks. You know, it doesn't look like, hey, this is, you know, like that was the problem with Wrong Turn 2 was it was shot on such a super low budget. It looks like a super fucking low budget movie. Yeah. This looks like a movie, but he got fucked over. We're, of course, talking about Knights of Badassdom.
Such a great title. This is harkening back to a very unsung tradition in 80s horror, which is the heavy metal horror film.
Yes.
If you guys haven't had a chance to see things like Black Roses or Trick or Treat or Demons, there's a whole subset of horror that is like it tying in directly like these horrific images and themes to heavy metal music, and it's such a beautiful unholy marriage.
It's because, you know, heavy metal was very much going the opposite direction, where it was like they were representing, you know, like one of the biggest bands in the world had a zombie as their mascot. So, you know, horror was a very big part of heavy metal. Heavy metal music was a very big part of horror, and that was just all together. And so here is the heavy metal horror film mixed with LARPing.
Yes, because again, the fantasy themes and heavy metal stuff, like, you know, Iron Maiden, and then LARPing, like, again, just very natural, unholy marriages. And you put all these things together and you have this really fun story that ends up being a cautionary tale about heavy metal, about LARPing, and about how filmmakers can get supremely fucked by studios no matter how big they are.
And I would argue that this is easily the very best, most talented cast.
It's an amazing cast.
Of any of the films that we're talking about today. Like, it is, like, the, you know, of course, the
Ryan Kwaden.
Yes.
From this is the other thing I noticed. Almost every single principal actor is a big TV star right now. You got Peter Dinklage from Game of Thrones.
Yes.
He's fucking phenomenal in this movie.
Who had not gotten hired for Game of Thrones. He'd auditioned for it. He was shooting Knights of Badassdom, then got the call that he'd gotten the gig and was told, we need you next week, and so they had to shoot him out in like 6 days on this movie.
Damn.
Like, he was a major character in the movie, and they had to be like, we're about to lose Peter. So this is just the beginning of where things start going wrong with this movie.
And then, of course, Ryan Kwan from True Blood, Summer Glau, formerly of Firefly and currently of Arrow, Danny Pudi from Community. Hell, even the guy playing King Diamond is Michael Gladys, who was Paul Kinsey on Mad Men.
And
Josh Molina from The West Wing and Sports Night, who's now on Scandal, turns up in a small role. Love that guy. And then, of course, yes, Steve Zahn, who, while not in my whole TV actor theory thing, is actually a big star and has been in movies. And
is fucking talented as fuck.
And adds to this amazing cast, for sure. Steve Zahn's character is a guy who they describe as being an accidental millionaire. And so he lives in a castle because he's rich and he can do whatever the fuck he wants. He lives in this castle. Kwaden lives there, very into heavy metal, not much of a LARPer or a D&D player, but goes on a bender after his girlfriend breaks up with him and wakes up on the field of imaginary battle. And it's just like, what the fuck did you guys drag me to?
Yeah.
And it turns out what they dragged him to is the accidental summoning of a very real demon.
Yeah. And what starts out as a LARP, one of the guys accidentally, he comes into possession of a book of demon summoning, accidentally summons a demon. Demon goes around killing people, and then they have to stop the demon while running around with all people playing fake, you know, fighting fake demons.
And really digging into the odd politics of like LARPing D&D guild kind of things, where it's like the game master is making, like, oh, you've been struck. And it's like, I wasn't hit. It's like, yes, you were. I am the game master. You go down. It's like, this is bullshitteth, you know, and stuff like that. Like, they even dig into the weird politics of geekdom.
Oh, yeah.
And I like that.
And the thing is a lot of this movie works. But there was, and we won't go into the nitty gritty of it, but there was some weird financing stuff.
Well, I mean, I won't go too much into it, but basically what happened is you had a guy from a studio. I won't mention the name of the studio because I don't want to sling too much shit here. The guy who was the CEO decided to, at the last minute, after, by the way, the trailer for this played at Comic-Con, ripped the doors off. Like, people were so excited for this. Could not wait to see it. And then all of a sudden, this head of the studio, takes the film, takes the print, takes everything that they've been working on, and says that he is taking over the film because of financial, it was going over budget, and there were things that weren't cleared. But the thing is, the two producers on the film that he, like, unceremoniously dumped and took the film away from had cleared every single charge, every single expense with this guy. So he's completely going back on his word and completely violating the Directors Guild mandates and the contract that Joe Lynch signed, because then he goes and edits it himself.
Yes. And then cheaps out on visual effects and shows the film without even telling Joe.
A 70-minute cut of the film that, by the way, the ending of this movie is really what doesn't work, because there's so much of it. It's like, really, that's it? How could that possibly be it? There's so much that feels like it's missing. And that's the version that not only did they release limitedly, but that's the version that he took to like film markets trying to get money for it, like trying to sell to buyers. And it's just like, how the fuck can you sleep at night? Like, even Roger Corman would be like, dude, that's low. That's super low.
And there's the Corman alarm.
And there's the Corman alarm. Yeah.
Yeah, so he got really screwed on it. It's so the version that's out there is not his cut. It's not really his film. He shot it. There's rumors, there's talk that there may be a director's cut in the future.
Though, I hope so.
That this has done well enough on VOD and there's enough interest that might happen. I hope so too. I'd really like to see what Joe really had in mind. This was one of those films that it was sitting on a shelf for years. And every time I saw Joe, I'm like, when can I see it? He's like, I can't show it to you. Fuck. That was his first foray into, you know, that was actually Joe's first film, you know. It wasn't a direct-to-video movie. It was a film.
Yeah.
And then we move on into the final round, the where they are right now. Wait, one of the things we have not talked about,
yeah,
that another reason why these guys are in the same episode, they kind of made a TV show together.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of called Holliston. Maybe you saw it.
Holliston. Yeah.
Holliston.
Holliston.
So that was the thing that they were spending all their time on during this era. And sadly, the network tanked.
One of their stars died.
Yes.
Which is unfortunate. Odorous from Gwar.
Gwar.
Passed away.
How dare you even pause for a second as if you don't know Gwar?
Calm down, nerd. And again, like, these guys just can't catch a fucking break.
They can't catch a break.
And that moves us on into Joe Lynch's most recent movie,
which is fucking awesome.
Oh my God in heaven. It is called Everly, and it was one of the blacklisted scripts from 2010. And it is basically, I don't know what you want to call it, movie in a box, self-contained movie, movie play. I will say this, I was a little skeptical that an effective action movie can be crafted in such a small space as one apartment. Because, I mean, if you think about it, even The Raid got a whole building.
Yeah.
Like, this is an action movie that takes place essentially in one room. One, like, not just one apartment, but, like, one room of the apartment. So, basically, what you have here is Selma Hayek playing the former love interest of a gang, a mob boss. She has broken things off with him, and he has sent a team of bad dudes to rough her up and teach her a little lesson. Well, the joke's on you, buddy, because what Selma Hayek ends up doing is teaching a lesson to every bad guy in the tri-state area vis-a-vis Assault on Precinct 13, except she's completely by herself.
Yeah, she fucks them up, and then this guy sends in everyone. It's like you can almost imagine, because you don't actually see it, but you can almost imagine it off screen being that bit from The Professional where it's like, send in everyone. Who?
Everyone!
And so, you
people
know,
from other movies. Yeah, we don't care.
Just, you know, hookers.
People from other genres of movies.
You've got hookers trying to kill her. You've got assassins. You've got bizarro, quirky, strange killers.
Yeah.
Like
if Cirque du Soleil went violent.
Yeah. You've got, you got snipers. Like, it's just like, we're setting everybody, and she starts killing fucking everybody, and it is a violent, rough, funny, wonderful fucking film. It is so much fun. It is just a super over the top, really great action film.
I mean, it works especially because Selma Hayek embraces the hell out of this role and dives head first through the plate glass window that is the central conceit. I mean, they keep throwing everything at her and she just refuses to die. Like, this is probably like the premier survivor story. And it's not even a horror film. As much as he's known for horror films, his ultimate survivor story, his premier survivor story is Everly, for God's sake.
Yeah.
And you're right. It is absolutely so much fun to watch because it doesn't take itself too seriously. But that doesn't mean it cuts corners with story or character or stunts. Oh my God, the stunt work in this movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, it's a really, really well put together movie. And it's a movie that also, you know, struggled with its own issues trying to get made. I know that when they were having digital effects put together, there was a revolution in the country where the
what?
And, yeah, like this is how fucked these guys get. Like,
why can't they catch a break?
You know, they're trying to do the digital effects of their film, you know, to Everly, and the people are literally in their country, like on
revolting.
Their knees. Type it, you know, doing the various computer work,
yeah.
Keeping their head down because bullets are going,
Jesus,
you know,
Christ.
And buildings are blowing up and like shit is going down. And it was, I believe it was in the Ukraine, I think was where
good God.
They did the effects for this. I believe that's where it was, but yeah. But so they were like, they were having a nightmare with their visual effects because they're like, oh my God, for the love of God, please stop the revolution so we can finish our goddamn movie.
It's really inconsiderate, Ukraine. I'm just saying.
Yeah, just way to go, guys. But yeah, so that, but it all works out and it becomes a really great fishbowl story where, you know.
Oh, it was I'm sorry, it was Serbia.
Serbia.
Because I remember joking during Fantastic Fest that this was the other Serbian film that played Fantastic Fest and was almost as fun.
Yeah, that was, it was, he had a rough time.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, the movie comes out and it works and it's a really good, fun movie that never leaves the building.
Yeah.
and mostly almost spends almost the entire movie on one floor. Mm-hmm. And mostly in a single apartment, and it's all very, very well done, and I love the hell out of this movie. And that moves us on to the final film we'll talk about this episode.
Yes.
Digging Up the Marrow,
which I still have not had a chance to see.
Oh well, then I will briefly talk about Digging Up the Marrow.
Well, you know, speaking of can't catch a break. Okay, so I went to watch this movie a few days ago, and my Xbox One, which has worked perfectly for every movie I've ever watched, decided to not play movies anymore. So I'm like, okay, fine. I'll go out to the garage. I'll get my old Blu-ray player. I'll set it up. Couldn't find the remote. Can't play it without the remote. I literally can't fucking watch this movie. These guys can't catch a break, and apparently neither can I when it comes to watching Digging Up the Marrow. So
yeah, no,
tell us about Digging Up the Marrow.
No, Digging Up the Marrow is really good. It's essentially... I'm just going to come out and say it. I know Adam likes to kind of keep it hidden, but I think if you explain the conceit to it, it's easier to sell. Essentially, the thing with Digging Up the Marrow, and if you haven't seen it and you're already sold on Adam's stuff, now's the good time to turn this off because we're going to talk about this and wrap up. And
yeah.
If you don't want it spoiled, I'm not going to spoil too much. But essentially, it's Adam is himself. And Adam and Joe are in this, and Adam is is playing Adam Green, filmmaker, who gets approached by this crazy guy who is played by Ray Wise.
The amazing Ray Wise.
And Ray Wise is a guy who has found a group of people who live underground, a group of monsters who live underground in this area, and he's been keeping track of it, and he's been trying to prove their existence for quite some time and get someone to believe him. And Adam goes along thinking this is a joke, that this guy's crazy, and then weird shit starts happening. And it's a really, really good, fun monster movie. If you're fans of things like Nightbreed, aka Cabal, then this movie will be right up your alley.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, Adam, people ask Adam at every Q&A apparently, and they raise their and yeah, was this inspired by Cabal or Nightbreed? And Adam's like, yeah, I'm a big fan of those, and I didn't even think about that when I was writing this. And then the first Q&A I ever did, somebody said, was this inspired by Cabal or Nightbreed? And he's like, fuck, it totally was. And so now that's what he opens up with, the story of, by the way, it was totally influenced by this without me ever thinking, I'm going to make my Nightbreed. So yeah, so it is a really cool movie. I wish you'd seen it, because I really want to discuss it. When you watch it, we need to get together and have coffee and talk about this, because I really like this movie. I've seen you know, both this and Everly like 3 times now. I own them both. They're travel movies for me now.
Nice,
because they're both really fast paced and fun, and really just the thing is these two guys. Are such great cineasts. You know, they mm-hmm. really do. They know their cinema. They know how to put together their cinema. And what they've done on budgets. You know, they have budgets that, you know, most of the movies you see just aren't made for those kind of budgets.
Yeah.
And they keep putting together really great stuff under limited, you know, with lots of restrictions on them. And they keep delivering. You know, the way, you know, just look at Wrong Turn 2 and know that this young director with no power was hired to make that movie for $500,000 without the ability to change the script and to make the best movie he can. And then watch how many times you laugh. And how many things that aren't scripted but occur in the movie, you know, in the way it's shot, or you know the way an actor reacts to something, and you can see just what these guys can do. And I feel like they're kind of I feel like these are two of the caged tigers of cinema right now, and of genre. That when somebody finally realizes, hey, let's give these guys $20-30 million, let's give these guys a $50 million movie, let's see what they can do, these guys are just gonna break out something that everybody's gonna be like, holy fuck, where have these guys been this whole time? And the answer is, they've been right here, you just haven't been paying attention.
I'm gonna craft a little metaphor here based on Everly. Right now, these two guys are Selma Hayek in that room, in that building, and you've seen what they can do when they're confined to that room. Now imagine what would happen if Selma Hayek got out of that room with that much rage and that much intensity and the kind of damage that she could do. That's what's happening with these guys right now. They're in that room, they're kicking ass, and we're just waiting for the opportunity for one of them to stop getting fucked over and start really making strides for being a household name. And that is why these two are modern masters of junk food. And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which for this week, I'm citing something specifically from Hatchet 2 and going with Chips Ahoy cookies.
Yes, you are.
One of my favorite scenes in that movie is you have this room full of like hunters and skip tracers and all these just like really badass dudes. And there's a tray, one of whom, by the way, is Lloyd Kaufman.
Oh, they're most of them in that room are writers, directors. You know, Marcus Dunstan's in there. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of their friends who are, you know, so it's literally a whole bunch of genre people sitting playing these hunters and badasses.
Yes. But there's a scene where basically they're handing out chocolate chip cookies. That's what Tony Todd's like shopkeeper guy has come up with for snacks, and it leads in like these guys are taking the cookies, and then there's this whole discussion from an actor named Colton Dunn, who plays possibly the funniest character in the movie. Starts like, "Hey man, are there any more cookies, or is this pretty much it? Can we get some more cookies over here? I only got like one, and I don't think that's an even distribution of cookies." I agree with you, Colton Dunn, because you know what? The careers of Adam Green and Joe Lynch, we are out of cookies. We need more cookies. We need you to stop getting fucked over. The plate is empty for now, but you need to keep baking up these ideas and keep producing, because we want to see more of it. We have run out of cookies. We need more. Get on it, Adam Green and Joe Lynch. But that's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. I want to remind you once again that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/massiveworm or on twitter.com@massiveworm. That's MASSAWYRM.
Fantastic. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, or you can find my Facebook page on the Facebooks, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And definitely check out oneofus.net, my home away from home. A lot of great geek blogs and podcasts over there. Really appreciate that. But yeah, that's going to do it for this first chapter of Modern Junk Food Masters.
If there's anything on this list you haven't seen, fucking go out and watch it.
Fucking go out and watch it.
All right, come on.
And enjoy some chocolate chip cookies while you do it.
Oh, hell yeah.